In 1985, at 22, I found myself in a cheap South Florida motel with more cocaine than intended, using it compulsively until it was gone. My homeless friend's declaration that there would never be enough cocaine for us struck me as profoundly true. 6 months later, surprisingly clean and sober, I faced a life-changing decision: continue self-destruction or find another path. I chose an unexpected route, pursuing a PhD in neuroscience to understand addiction. This book has become a cultural touchstone in addiction science, praised by neuroscientists and recovery specialists alike. Celebrities like Russell Brand have cited it as essential reading for understanding the biological basis of addiction. What makes this work particularly powerful is how it weaves cutting-edge neuroscience with the raw, personal experience of addiction, a combination rarely found in scientific literature but desperately needed in our current epidemic of substance use disorders affecting 1 in 5 people globally. Our brain serves as the sole mediator between ourselves and the world, with most neural real estate dedicated to sensing, perceiving, and responding to our environment. This remarkable organ converts environmental signals into electrical and chemical energy, its native language. Every experience, including drug use, registers as changes in brain structure and function. For experiences to be meaningful, they must stand out against a background of neural stability. The brain functions primarily as a contrast detector, distinguishing experiences from monotony through neurochemical changes in specific circuits. This process requires homeostasis, maintaining a stable baseline through set points, comparators, and adjustment mechanisms. Without this stability, we couldn't detect good or bad events against our neutral baseline. The brain's reward center was discovered in the 1950s when researchers Olds and Milner implanted electrodes in rats' brains. When rats could self-stimulate this area, they did so obsessively, ignoring food, sex, and sleep to the point of death. This groundbreaking research revealed that electrical stimulation triggered dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens, part of the brain's limbic system. All addictive drugs share the ability to stimulate this mesolimbic dopamine system, creating pleasure signals. Dopamine in the mesolimbic pathway doesn't simply signal pleasure, but rather the anticipation of pleasure, that anxious, lip-smacking foretaste of something significant approaching. This system alerts us to potentially meaningful events, whether pleasurable, surprising, novel, or valuable. A second dopamine circuit, the nigrostriatal pathway, enables action toward or away from stimuli. Together, these pathways make us appreciate opportunities, mesolimbic, and enable us to pursue them, nigrostriatal. Drugs stimulate both pathways more powerfully than natural reinforcers, delivering faster, more frequent, and more reliable dopamine surges than our evolutionary history prepared us for. They operate according to 3 fundamental principles. They can only change the rate of existing processes, they always have side effects because they aren't targeted in delivery, and most importantly, the brain adapts to counteract their effects. This third principle explains why regular coffee drinkers become lethargic without caffeine, and why alcohol users aren't relaxed by drinking, they're anxious without it. The brain's compensatory response means regular users need the drug just to feel normal, while getting high becomes increasingly elusive. Socrates, on his deathbed, observed the curious relationship between pleasure and pain, how pursuing one often leads to the other. This ancient insight predicted modern discoveries about how our bodies maintain stability through oscillating between opposite biological states. The brain's most distinctive feature is its capacity to dynamically respond to environmental stimuli and even anticipate them. This plasticity enables learning in all organisms with a central nervous system. Adaptation to drugs begins immediately upon first exposure, causing effects like poor sleep after drinking, as alcohol's depressant effects are counteracted by the brain becoming more excited than normal. Tachyphylaxis, acute tolerance, explains why identical blood alcohol concentrations produce different levels of impairment depending on whether levels are rising or falling. During rising phases, pleasure and impairment increase, but when falling, both are greatly reduced as the brain adapts. This counteraction occurs with all drugs affecting the nervous system, becoming stronger and more persistent with repeated exposure. Solomon and Corbett's opponent process theory provides a scientific framework for understanding addiction. It describes two opposing neural processes, the A process, what the drug does to the brain, and the B process, the brain's compensatory response. Initially, drug effects are experienced fully, but as the B process develops, the experience diminishes. Unlike the A process, which remains consistent with identical doses, the B process grows stronger, faster, and longer lasting with repeated exposure. Eventually, this adaptation means drugs primarily function to stave off withdrawal rather than produce pleasure. The withdrawal and craving states are always exactly opposite to the drug's original effects. Relaxants produce anxiety during withdrawal, stimulants cause lethargy, and painkillers lead to increased suffering. Addiction differs fundamentally from diseases like tumors or diabetes that can be definitively diagnosed through tests and potentially cured by removing the problematic element. As a disorder affecting thought, emotion, and behavior through widespread adaptations across multiple brain circuits, addiction resists simple cures. Even after decades of sobriety, the addictive mindset persists. I don't want moderation, I want excess. From my first high until long after my final bowl, marijuana was like a beloved friend. Unlike others who might become sleepy or paranoid, for me, it was nearly perfect. Each morning, I'd wake to life's bleakness before remembering, with newlywed-like excitement, that I could get high. Those first hits reliably transformed the gray dust of reality into beauty and meaning. If alcohol is a pharmacological sledgehammer and cocaine a laser, marijuana is like a bucket of red paint, broadly enhancing environmental stimuli while producing widespread modulatory effects. THC acts throughout the brain in trillions of synapses, with receptors distributed densely across both cortical and subcortical structures. This unique distribution surprised researchers, as most drugs affect far fewer brain regions. The endocannabinoid system includes natural brain chemicals like anandamide, bliss in Sanskrit, and 2-AG that work in reverse of typical neurotransmitters, flowing upstream across synapses to essentially highlight important neural messages, like adding exclamation points to significant experiences. This explains why when high, ordinary stimuli become extraordinary. Mall visits transform into rich playgrounds, pizza becomes profoundly delicious, music transcendent, and concepts mind-blowing. Unfortunately, when everything is highlighted as meaningful, nothing truly stands out, making it difficult to recall experiences later. More problematically, chronic use leads to downregulation of CB1 receptors, making ordinary life seem dull and uninspiring when not high, the brain's adaptation to maintain homeostasis. After getting sober, my cravings for alcohol subsided within a year, but my yearning for marijuana persisted for 9 excruciating years. The brain's adaptation to chronic marijuana exposure is predictable but profound. Downregulation dramatically reduces both the number and sensitivity of CB1 receptors throughout the brain. This explains the long-debated amotivational syndrome. When receptors diminish, the world genuinely becomes less interesting without the drug. My first months without pot were miserable. Everything seemed bland beyond belief. But about 3 months into sobriety, I experienced a revelation while walking in Minneapolis. The fall foliage suddenly appeared in brilliant technicolor as my receptors recovered. For those who use marijuana, the key lesson is clear. Infrequent, intermittent use prevents downregulation and its consequences: tolerance, dependence, and losing interest in the unenhanced world. The relationship between opiate users and their drug is a love story of unparalleled intensity and heartbreak, making Romeo and Juliet seem like adolescent drama. Initially, opiates present as the perfect companion, offering subtle yet profound contentment that polishes cloudy afternoons and mutes life's disappointments. The early relationship provides a myopic sense of fulfillment where everything beyond the drug recedes to a distant horizon. But this perfect romance inevitably sours as tolerance develops. The drug becomes increasingly distant just as the user's longing grows desperate. What began as perfect solace transforms into hopeless yearning, then deep grief, and finally, bleak isolation. The devastation is immense precisely because the initial comfort was so complete. Users degrade themselves seeking even fragments of their former bliss, but find only brief, unsatisfying reunions that can't possibly last. Narcotics dominate our collective consciousness as opiate addiction plays out thousands of times daily worldwide. Over one-fifth of Americans use opiates during their lifetime, legally or illegally. As the second most addictive drug after nicotine, opiates cause more deaths than automobile accidents. In 2012 alone, 259 million prescriptions were written, enough for every American adult. Most heroin users begin with prescription painkillers before turning to cheaper street drugs. Opiates derive their classification from shared molecular structure and effects, particularly pain relief. Used for at least 7,000 years, these compounds remain the go-to treatment for intense pain, despite side effects like respiratory depression causing overdose deaths, constipation, and euphoria, the latter being what makes them addictive. Their appeal is neurologically straightforward. They mimic endorphins, our natural painkillers. While most people know about endorphins, those feel-good chemicals released during exercise, spicy food, or sex, few recognize the equally important family of anti-opiates that evolved to counteract them. These compounds produce exactly opposite effects, enhancing suffering and restlessness. This balance serves survival. After escaping danger, perceiving pain becomes necessary to address injuries. Opiate addiction produces legendary tolerance, dependence, and craving, stronger than almost any other drug. Adaptations begin with the very first dose and rapidly intensify with use. A dose that initially worked well soon produces minimal effect, requiring more drug, which triggers greater adaptation in a vicious cycle. Tolerance becomes mind-boggling. Addicts can take 150 times a lethal dose for non-users and feel merely right. Recovery is painfully slow. It takes nearly 6 days to regain just half sensitivity to morphine compared to nicotine's half hour. Drug use is driven by both positive reinforcement, pleasure, and negative reinforcement, reducing unpleasant feelings. Alcohol reduces anxiety, making it especially appealing to naturally anxious people. But brain adaptation undermines self-medication attempts, increasing anxiety and requiring more alcohol. Punishment, whether positive, unpleasant consequences like hangovers, or negative, losing valued things, generally fails to deter addiction. Alcohol seems deceptively simple to understand. Its molecule is small and nearly everyone is familiar with it. Fermentation has been used for at least 11,000 years across virtually all human cultures, with early drinks having relatively low alcohol concentrations until distillation was discovered around the 1st century AD, creating spirits with 40 to 50% alcohol content. Paradoxically, alcohol's small molecular structure makes it harder to study than larger, more complex drugs like cocaine or heroin, as it affects multiple brain sites rather than specific receptors. It's metabolized at a constant rate, primarily in the liver, with efficiency varying by genetics, drinking history, and age. Alcohol's primary neural effects include enhancing GABA, the brain's main inhibitory neurotransmitter, reducing glutamate activity, the main excitatory neurotransmitter, activating opioid receptors, impeding neurotransmitter release, and at high doses, compromising neural membrane integrity. Alcohol acts as a neurological sledgehammer, affecting virtually all aspects of brain function. At low doses, one or two drinks, it blurs edges and reduces anxiety. With more drinks, inhibitions decrease as cortical monitoring shuts down and emotional regions are freed from constraints. Approaching the legal blood alcohol limit leads to sedation, impaired speech, and coordination. Higher doses can cause unconsciousness, justifying alcohol's classification as a sedative hypnotic. Alcohol's devastating impact extends far beyond individual users. Excessive drinking leads to cardiovascular problems, liver disease, pancreatitis, and increased cancer risks. Even moderate drinking is harmful. One drink daily is associated with diseases leading to premature death, with each additional drink worsening outcomes. In the U.S., over 25% of adults reported binge drinking in the previous month, with nearly 40% of college students doing the same. Despite alcohol's widespread use, over 85% of adults worldwide drink, only about 10% develop problems. Yet alcohol remains catastrophically deadly, causing 3.3 million deaths annually worldwide and 90,000 deaths yearly in the U.S., twice as many as prescription opioids and heroin overdoses combined. It's the third largest cause of preventable death, contributing substantially to emergency room visits, automobile accidents, domestic abuse, and violence. Stimulants are the most popular mind-altering drugs worldwide, representing the low-hanging fruit of the addictive drug family. Unlike sedatives that share both action and effects, stimulants are classified solely by their effects, increasing movement, arousal, and alertness. Humans have enjoyed natural stimulants from plants like khat and ma huang for thousands of years, and their widespread appeal stems partly from their legal status, caffeine and nicotine, and the fact that being alert and active is rarely socially inappropriate. Stimulants produce bizarre behavioral and cognitive changes over time, including stereotypy, purposeless, repetitive movements that users call punding or tweaking, like mindlessly sorting, cleaning, or disassembling objects. Other alarming long-term effects include cardiovascular strain from overstimulating the sympathetic nervous system and stimulant psychosis, where cognitive arousal becomes so sensitized it produces paranoia and hallucinations. Unlike other addictive drugs, stimulants create a growing approach avoidance conflict with repeated use. What begins as pure pleasure becomes an ambivalent mix of wanting and not wanting. Rats given daily cocaine initially run toward it, but eventually show vacillation, running toward, then away from it repeatedly. This may explain why cocaine addiction often comes with anxiety disorders that worsen as addiction progresses. Caffeine, the world's most popular psychoactive drug, occupies a unique position. It causes tolerance and dependence, but isn't considered harmful enough to meet addiction criteria. It offers documented benefits, including improved mood, memory, alertness, and physical performance, while potentially reducing risks of Parkinson's disease and type 2 diabetes. Nicotine's mechanism explains its powerful grip on users. When chronically present, it causes upregulation of nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, NACHRs, seemingly counterintuitive since agonists typically downregulate receptors. This occurs because nicotine primarily desensitizes these receptors, triggering a homeostatic increase in receptor sensitivity and number. Cocaine's mechanism is remarkably straightforward. It blocks the reuptake of monoamine neurotransmitters, dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, preventing their recycling and prolonging their effects. Without transporters to clear these neurotransmitters, synaptic transmission persists much longer, turning dopamine's notification from a brief signal into something more like a blaring alarm. Methamphetamine abuse affects about 1 million chronic users in the United States, with rapidly growing markets in East and Southeast Asia. With approximately 37 million users worldwide, twice the number using either cocaine or heroin, meth ranks among the most popular synthetic drugs globally. Its history includes widespread military use during World War II by all three superpowers, potentially influencing the war's outcome. Psychedelics represent a unique category of mind-altering substances that primarily activate serotonin 2A receptors. Unlike many other drugs discussed in this book, most scientists don't consider true psychedelics, LSD, mescaline, DMT, psilocybin, to be addictive, and they may potentially offer therapeutic benefits despite their strict regulation worldwide. The scientific study of psychedelics began with German chemist Arthur Hefter's isolation of mescaline from peyote in 1898, While psilocybin, mescaline, and DMT are natural compounds used for millennia in indigenous sacred rituals, LSD was created synthetically by Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann in 1938. After accidentally ingesting a small amount in 1943, Hofmann experienced an uninterrupted stream of fantastic pictures, extraordinary shapes with intense kaleidoscopic play of colors. LSD differs from natural psychedelics like psilocybin, DMT, and mescaline primarily in its extraordinary potency, just 5,100 micrograms, 0.0005 grams, delivered through a paper tab, induces a 6 to 12 hour trip. All induce rapid tolerance, making regular use pointless, a key difference from addictive drugs. While I could imagine living without most drugs, including alcohol and even cocaine, which I'd grown to despise, the thought of never experiencing psychedelics again was crushing. Even years into sobriety, I found myself caught in a logical koan. I can do any drug I want, as long as I don't really want to do it. Albert Hofmann's hopes for psychedelics as aids to better living may soon be realized. Recent clinical trials at prestigious institutions like Johns Hopkins, NYU, and Imperial College London have shown promising benefits for depression, addiction, and end-of-life anxiety. Most studies use psilocybin for its shorter duration, though the FDA recently approved the first trial of ayahuasca for depression. Studies with terminal patients involve controlled doses in comfortable settings with trained guides and facilitative music. Participants typically have two sessions separated by weeks, during which they experience deep introspection. Terminal patients report greater acceptance and decreased anxiety about dying after these experiences. These drugs likely work by interacting with serotonin 2A receptors, inducing activity in genes associated with neuroplasticity and disrupting established neural connections. This may allow the brain to reset maladaptive patterns responsible for psychiatric illness. Though still early, this research suggests we may be approaching a more humane treatment for depression, anxiety, and antisocial disorders, one with fewer side effects than existing pharmacotherapies. The question, why me, emerges when facing addiction's ultimatum. Despite self-deception and denial, thinking oneself too smart, resolute, or young to have a problem, eventually reality becomes undeniable. The puzzling observation that many people use substances without developing addiction fuels this questioning. The pendulum has swung from viewing addiction as moral weakness to seeing it as purely biological disorder, but neither extreme captures the full picture. Four primary factors contribute to addiction: inherited biological disposition, extensive drug exposure, particularly during adolescence, and catalyzing environmental factors, with any combination potentially breaching the dam of control. Evidence for addiction's genetic component comes from two main sources. Identical twins, sharing nearly 100% of DNA, have twice the likelihood of similar addiction patterns compared to regular siblings, 50% share DNA. And biological children of addicts maintain elevated risk even when adopted by non-addicted families. However, genetic risk isn't simple. It involves thousands of genes with varying impacts, interacting with environment and family history. Open-mindedness and humility are necessary for good science. We've learned that our genetic inheritance is far more complex than just DNA sequences. Epigenetic modifications, literally on top of DNA, regulate gene activity and constitute cellular memory of our ancestors' experiences. These modifications may account for the missing inheritance in addiction. Beyond epigenetics, solid evidence shows that early exposure to marijuana causes lasting changes in brain structure for embryos, children, and adolescents. These structural changes produce cognitive deficits and make individuals permanently less sensitive to rewards, leading them to take more drugs later in life. The relationship between early use and later problems is both causal and correlational. Those predisposed to seek novel experiences may use throughout life, but starting early, before brain maturation, causes neural changes that foster problem use in adulthood. There may indeed be personality aspects that incline someone toward addiction, though the relationship isn't simple. natural variation in dopamine signaling contributes to how people respond to potential rewards. Rather than simply creating pleasure, high dopamine tone correlates with enhanced sensitivity to potentially rewarding experiences, as if the message about something valuable were being delivered at higher volume, drowning out drawbacks. Despite massive research efforts, chronic brain-related disorders like Alzheimer's, depression, schizophrenia, and addictions still lack causal explanations and effective cures. Addiction rates continue to increase despite small advances in understanding. Neuroscience remains in its infancy compared to fields like astronomy or physics. A century ago, astrophysicists were certain they understood the universe's size and structure before discoveries about quantum mechanics, dark matter, and other paradigm shifts. Today's astrophysicists are more aware of what they don't understand, showing increased humility that catalyzes further discovery. What can be done about the addiction crisis? Some take extreme approaches, like Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte's war on drugs that has killed thousands, or U.S. states considering withholding overdose antidotes from repeat offenders. Other interventions include brain lesions, deep brain stimulation, or vaccines that permanently neutralize specific drugs. These, if you can't control your behavior, we'll do it for you, approaches raise practical and ethical questions. When would such interventions be appropriate? Only as last resorts for confirmed addicts, for early-stage users, for at-risk children? Most people recoil at such ideas, recognizing the slippery slopes of behavior control and the value of personal freedom, even to make mistakes. While many addicts die from their behavior, millions recover successfully. Recovery isn't about restriction, but expansion, a process that restores our most precious commodity, freedom to choose. Addiction strips us of this freedom, which is why imposing permanent limits on choices makes no sense as a cure. Despite 30 years of sobriety, I haven't been cured of addiction. Unlike my hepatitis C, which was completely eradicated after treatment, my addiction persists in how my brain responds to pharmacological treats. When offered a glass of wine, I briefly wonder why anyone would want just one glass. At pubs, I secretly judge my husband for choosing low-alcohol beers, believing the value of any drug lies in its ability to take me away from myself. Addiction is highly context-dependent. Two important factors are worsening the addiction crisis. First, technological advances have dramatically increased drug potency and delivery. The difference between chewing a coca leaf and smoking crack cocaine is like drinking from a teacup versus a fire hose. Another modern change is solitary drug taking versus culturally endorsed ritual use. Isolation is both an index and driver of abuse. The opiate epidemic reveals what's been true all along. Most addicts cross into uncontrolled use in plain sight, with virtually no chance of regaining control once they cross that threshold. Despite neuroscience advances, we've had little impact because of the brain's powerful capacity to thwart drug effects and our problematic responses to each other. We nourish addiction by embracing false dichotomies like us versus them and the myth that happiness can be pursued individually. Those struggling with addiction may have enhanced sensitivity to factors promoting isolation and alienation. As a society, we're suffering from depth deprivation, depth found most naturally in honest connections. While we've stopped expecting addicts to cure themselves, waiting for a biomedical cure means missing our own role in the epidemic. Instead of wringing our hands, we might try reaching for another's.